Hello and welcome to Fundraising as a Female Founder, the podcast all about how to raise funds for your business as a woman. I'm your host, Alice Audley. With less than 1p in every pound of venture capital investment going to all female-founded companies, it's time to start asking some very hard questions about the fundraising landscape. On this podcast, I will speak to women who have either raised money, are raising money, are an angel, work in venture capital, or work within companies' investment teams, and get their views, advice, and lessons about how to successfully raise funds as a female founder. Who knows, I may speak to a couple of men who have invested in female-led companies too. So without further ado, you're listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder. I hope you enjoy the series. Today on Fundraising as a Female Founder, I'm joined by Isabel Garvey, who is Managing Director of Abbey Road Studios and was responsible for launching Europe's first music technology incubator, Abbey Road Red. Abbey Road Red offers music tech entrepreneurs a programme of mentorship, access to Abbey Road's facilities, and a platform for exposure. Isabel started her career at Morgan Stanley and then worked at venture capital and private equity company Compass Partners. She's advised many startups on both growth strategy and funding options, and larger corporations on acquisitions, so has experiences on both sides of the table.
I'm Isabel Garvey and I'm the Managing Director of Abbey Road Studios.
And can you take me back through your career? So how did you end up here?
I have a very meandering path. So I have a dark history in investment banking that I like to skip through quite quickly. So I started investment banking, then moved to private equity, and then through complete serendipity, one of the headhunters I was working with to find another finance job put me in for a role at EMI Music as chief of staff, I think it was, for the chairman and vice chairman at the time. And it was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever done in my whole life, but I got the job. And I thought, well, people do MBAs to have that kind of a career change. And it was a really exciting time slash disruptive time in the music industry because it was Napster was at its height. There was a huge amount of piracy. iTunes had only just launched as the kind of paid for alternative. And at the time, I think I joined in 2004 and digital was 2% of the industry. And so my role when I first went in was to think about what the organisation and the industry would look like at 20% digital because they knew it was coming like a freight train. And so then, you know, my days at EMI were filled with that in the first place. And then I moved to Warner Music and I ran the digital music business at Warner for a number of years. And then I did some consulting, some digital media consulting on my own. I learned I'm not very good at working on my own, or I had plenty of clients, but I like being around people. And then I got a call to come and would I like to run Abbey Road?
And Abbey Road has a fund within it. So is this the first time of being in charge of a fund or?
So we don't have a fund, actually.
An incubator,
yeah. So, it's my first time running an incubator. I mean, through my career in music, I've been obviously very close to digital music startups or music tech startups. And when I came to Abbey Road, my remit here was to, you know, look at a brand that has global recognition and what could we do to actually take advantage of that, because we kind of just stuck to Northwest London. And so it was a fantastic remit. One of the things I uncovered here, I mean, obviously I knew a lot about Abbey Road coming here, but actually getting in under the skin of it is that there's a brilliant history of innovation in the building. You know, back in the day when it was a vertically integrated business, obviously it's easier, but you know, all of the really famous recording desks were invented and used here, tape effects, stereo sound was invented by Alan Blumlein and he ran all of his experiments at the studio here. So, the engineers here every day are breaking rules with an artist trying to create new sounds and
so it's a very entrepreneurial place.
Yeah. And so how we needed to kind of reconnect with innovation in a modern sense. And I guess at the back of my mind coming into the business fresh was, well, what is a studio going to be in 20 or 30 years time? We fundamentally believe people will still want to come to really inspirational, amazing sounding places with, you know, highly skilled team that can help them record well. But actually what you can do before and what you can do after your session in a studio has changed significantly with technology, and people can prepare so much and do so much in post afterwards. And actually for us, we're going to need a tech presence in that before and after for the brand to be significant in the music making process in the future. And so with that kind of in mind, we thought, well, how do we connect with innovation? How do we get back into those grassroots tech that's coming through? And we actually spent 12 months going around the market trying to figure out where music tech was, what the landscape was.
And what year was that in?
That was in 2014. And we were really pleasantly surprised. I was somewhat cynical, having, you know, grown up on the digital side, that I had lived through a kind of a Me Too phase, as in just businesses that were doing the same thing. Mm. And when we went out in 2014, it was just as machine learning and AI was becoming slightly more mainstream. And so we were seeing really different business models, really different applications. And so thought, actually, the best way to engage with that is through an incubator, because there was nothing that was supporting pure play music tech and interfacing with big music tech, licensing companies, major labels, is really hard when you're a startup. And so actually having someone who can support you through that process, just in terms of networking into the industry and knowing how to approach the music business, but then also supporting on the tech side and the innovation and entrepreneurial side.
So do you have desks here and things for?
So our program is kind of probably a bit unique as far as incubators are concerned. We put a completely bespoke 6-month program around each business. We only take 4 or 5 a year, so we kind of curate, it's highly curated. And then we build a program completely around the business, their needs, and where they want to be at the end of our program. And we don't have space here, but we do have meeting space that people can use. And obviously then they get a little studio time to kind of experiment with their tech if it's appropriate. But because we're ultimately owned by Universal Music, we also open up, you know, that major label. And we've built a network of, I think we're over 30 now, mentors to fill in the skill gaps that we don't have, like the people who can help you with your UI, you know, who are UI experts or deep tech experts or legal experts, whatever it may be. So we feel like we've rounded out the whole offering.
Yeah. And what are the best type of pitches that you see when someone wants to come and join your incubator? What makes people stand out?
I think there's a couple of things. It's usually the people first that grab you. So, you know, the personality, and I don't mean how vivacious they are, but just how passionate they are about their own project and their ability to articulate sometimes very complex ideas simply. So you're very much drawn by the passion of founders to start with. And then I think people who understand the either the problem they're trying to solve or the new market that they're trying to create. I think we see a lot of pitches of people who assume problems or assume solutions without truly getting under the skin of the industry itself.
Some more evidence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, then the obvious things of this traction, they have clients, they have an MVP, there's something that you can touch, that you can really understand what the tech can deliver.
So have people normally done an angel round before coming to the incubator to get that?
Yeah, we're 5 years deep into our incubator now, 15 businesses, and we've probably finessed it over the last few years. But we think our sweet spot actually is post-seed financing. So that's typically angel investing, and that, you know, depending on the business, that could be anything from 200,000 to 1 million, depending on the scale of what they're trying to achieve. So our sweet spot is post-seed, pre a big serious round of funding. That's when we can kind of lift them the most and kind of use the connections to make sure that they do secure that big round of funding.
And you mentioned that it's people kind of first. Have you seen some gender bias, do you think, in the funding world?
I probably don't see it because I'm a woman sitting evaluating these businesses, but it definitely exists in the funding world. I think my personal experience is, to generalise, I think there is a bit of a difference. I think particularly in early stage startups where the very obvious fundamentals may not be there yet, so you're kind of pitching an idea, I tend to see a lot more overconfidence in guys than girls, and it's striking the balance, right? You don't want to be overconfident, but I think some women don't stand proudly enough behind the idea that they've come up with. Having said that, I think there's a generation coming up now that have the right balance. And I've seen some really confident, really excellent pitches from young women. So it may well be personality and who's naturally going to succeed, who's naturally drawn to the startup space anyway.
What do you think of the venture capital funds that are launching? Because we are seeing more female funds that are investing in female-founded businesses. Do you think that the landscape has a long way to go, or do you think we're definitely on the right path?
I think we're, it is getting better, but I think it has a long way to go. I mean, the statistics speak for themselves, right? Female startups are still massively underfunded.
Yeah, I think 1p in the pound.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And yet, you know, all of these research papers that are coming out showing that diverse teams and teams led by women are, I think it's 28 to 30% more successful or more productive. I'd read another stat about 60%, but I can't remember the context of it. But, you know, diversity is key to better productivity and better ideation. So I think it still has a long way to go. I think it might improve in certain sectors before others. I think it's where you're talking very deep tech, I still think there's a bias that, you know, men know what they're talking about more than women, sadly. But again, you know, we're seeing a generation coming through now that haven't lived that bias yet. So I'm hoping it changes.
So there needs to be kind of at the roots, even at schools.
Yeah. So I ask myself this question a lot because we, in the 15 businesses we've had, we haven't had a single female founder. And, you know, as a female running this incubator, I've kind of made it a passion project to try and find more female founders.
Have female founders come in, or you just don't really see comparatively?
We've had a few, but really nothing serious. I've called out from the stage, I have met amazing female founders in adjacent industries and tried to help them along. I just haven't found anything specifically in music tech. And it's a real quandary. And so I've solicited advice from funds in particular who invest in female founders, saying, you know, where are they? What am I doing wrong? And their view is that it goes right back to grassroots, which is, you know, even women who are in, you know, highly mathematical or engineering type careers who would kind of point at towards going into deep tech, the statistics there again are that women are more likely to go into tech careers, but into larger companies, and are taking less risk than their male counterparts. And why is that? And so there are a number of programs. I know of one in Imperial, I think it is for sure, where they are trying to promote entrepreneurship to a female student base, to understand that there is risk, but it's not as great a risk as you kind of perceive from the outside.
And women are so much more common to use their own money than they are to use other people's money.
Yes, and slow to ask for, you know, money to take the business to the next level. So they might fund it for, you know, exploration, but then, you know, you almost need to be a year ahead of yourself the whole time. I think it's going to be a tricky nut to crack. But what I always say to women that I meet as well is that I don't think being in a startup and with that a failed startup does your CV any damage. In fact, it's actually, I find as an employer, I think that's really exciting, because the lessons you've learned from, you know, backing yourself, backing your own idea, going through all that heartache of trying to raise money. And then if it doesn't work out, you know, provided it wasn't anything, you know, seriously silly, actually you learn so much from that experience, and then you are more valuable than the person who's sat at a desk at an entry level job. And so how can we kind of convey that to a student base, that it is worth, you know, taking some risk and learning, you know, quite actually a diverse skill set? Because if you're in a small team, you have to do everything, right?
Mm-hmm. So. In terms of preparation before going out and raising funds, what would your advice there be? You know, sometimes you need your 50-page business plan. Others, it's just the investment deck. Mm. Should you allocate a period of time? How do you create a sense of urgency? What are all the kind of factors that you would advise thinking about before going out?
Yeah, I think it depends on what stage you're at. But assuming that you're, you know, a fairly new startup, and I think a lot of people struggle with this, is getting your story into a really succinct kind of sales pitch. I personally find that asking people to write that two-page you know, almost angel investment summary document is really good discipline. And then out of that comes the glossy PowerPoint presentation that becomes an investor deck. And then in terms of timing, you have to be a little ahead of yourself. You have to almost take time out of your business to devote to it, but you have to give yourself a firm timeline. So, you know, if you're starting now, that you give yourself till the end of April to find your funds, because it can go on forever. And also investors will string you along unless you...
Yeah, how do you put that kind of down? Do you tell them from the beginning, this is when I'm closing, so you're in or you're out there? Or is it finding the kind of second, third party?
I think you have to create a sense of urgency. It's very easy to say, it's very hard to deliver in practice. I think you have to create a sense of urgency. At a very seed level, most investors will want you to be putting a bit of money in, you know, even if it's you're only £5,000 in the world, but that you're that invested in it. And focus on finding a lead investor first that you think is going to add not just cash to your business, but add advisory and contacts and connections. And if you can lock that person in, then everything kind of falls in dominoes thereafter.
So smart money at the beginning is much more valuable. What about crowdfunding? Thoughts on crowdfunding?
I have mixed views on crowdfunding. I think if you're quite a product-based business, it can be useful. I think it's also very dangerous to do. We've seen two businesses actually that we've worked with here that have had amazingly successful crowdfunding campaigns, and then you have this very tight timeline to deliver product or service to a funding base. And one of the businesses we worked with, that was their undoing.
Really?
Yeah, because they were manufacturing a pretty complex headphone that was going to deliver spatial audio, and they raised 2 million on Kickstarter, and they couldn't get the manufacturing process.
Yeah, so much harder to deliver. Do you sometimes get in terms of Crowdcube and Seeders potentially better valuations, which leads me neatly on to valuations?
Yes, you can. Again, it depends on where you are in your process. I think you definitely give less equity away in a crowdfunding, but you have to kind of think about what you're trading. Sometimes you get better equity value, but then actually the value of the service that you're trading to that investor base, if you balance out the books, isn't as good value as you think, perhaps.
Yeah.
What we're seeing a trend towards now in some of the startups we're working with, which is interesting, is that they're kind of raising angel or institutional money, but putting a Seeders campaign alongside it to create almost a fan base for their product.
Exactly.
And that actually works incredibly well, because also you're kind of back solving for valuation. You have a very clear idea on valuation. You're not guessing at it because you have these institutional investors. But it's a really nice way to kind of have either PR value, create a fan base, or just early adopter supporters. That helps spread the word and help. Yeah.
When an investment deck comes to you and it has a valuation in it for the incubator, what are the kind of key? How do you say this isn't worth it? Like, what are the questions that you ask when you see the valuation?
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of it is we're not putting cash in per se, so I'm not looking at it through a VC type lens. But we see some pretty crazy numbers, and actually, our job as an incubator is to bring that back then to reality. I think we are used to taking valuations with a pinch of salt, because we're generally pre-revenue, so it's very hard to judge the valuation of a business. Some businesses will have really strong IP. If you've really strong defensible IP, then you have good rational reasoning for valuations. There's no magic rule of thumb if you're pre-revenue, pre-profit, because you're kind of just betting on the idea being worth something. And really, if you're, it becomes backward mathematics, right? If you're saying, right, I need $100,000 to get my MVP to the next level to really pitch it to clients, then you're trying to come up with justify a valuation that isn't giving too much equity away, rather than knowing for sure that you're worth $2 million at this point, right?
Do you think UK valuations are more sensible on the whole than US valuations?
Absolutely.
And that maybe we're listening to too many podcasts like Masters of Scale.
Yes, possibly. But I like that. And I was talking to someone from the US investment community a few weeks ago. And on the one hand, you know, their argument is that possibly, you know, is that a reason why we don't have as many unicorns in Europe? Because I guess we're all a little more conservative in valuation and less kind of ballsy in how we pitch. I don't know if that's true. But on the flip side, they were saying when you're looking at smaller businesses, actually, as an investor, it's so reassuring to have conversations that are based on reality rather than coming in at, you know, crazy, crazy valuations.
What's the worst pitch that you've ever seen?
I have a funny one. And the worst pitch I ever had was at Web Summit this year, where someone pulled me to the side. Now, granted, it wasn't a deck, okay? But he pulled me to the side and he said, "I've had the best idea." I was like, great, hit me. Musical beer.
Wow.
I was like, talk me through what you mean by musical beer. And he said, well, you know, artists just aren't getting paid in the music industry. So I had a thought that when they have a gig, instead of telling people to buy the single, they could just buy the beer for maybe a little bit more and it'd be the equivalent to buying a single. So they'd be rich.
So, and how did you break it to him that you wouldn't? Are you quite quick with, no, this isn't of interest, or?
Well, I mean, to be honest, that was so bizarre. But I did say you might want to go back and look at the fundamentals of the music industry and also look at the live events business, because the artist doesn't control the beer. So, yeah, I left it at that.
And did you say there were two bad ones?
So if you're talking about someone who comes then with, you know, a more formal pitch deck, nothing stands out as the worst, but there's nothing worse than a meandering deck. Actually, So the worst one I had was actually quite a decent pitch. It was about a kind of a generative music platform, but they hadn't quite decided how they were going to monetize. So picked five entirely different options of possibilities and then put a 100 million valuation at the end. So, that was pretty weird.
Do you think there's quite a lot of arrogance in the fundraising from sort of both sides? Confidence versus...
It's confidence.
And do you feel sometimes being pitched to by men that they could ever belittle?
Yeah, there's definitely some mansplaining that goes on in pitches, which I find, you know, given we're so niche and so expert in a particular vertical, that drives me potty.
Do you tell them to shut up?
No, it just turns me, you know, turns me off, the whole idea. I haven't had much of that, to be fair, but you do get a bit. So in terms of arrogance, I think... On the startup side, I think it's more driven by naivety and sometimes just a real, you know, need for cash, because it's life or death kind of on the cash side, that will drive crazy valuations, or, you know, because again, we're seeing businesses at a very seed stage. There's a lack of understanding about how financing progresses and where you need to pitch to start with. Sure, you might be worth 100 million in 5 years' time, but you don't put that on a piece of paper today, because it's all, you know, it all accrues over time. And then on the VC side, I think VC is difficult, because on the one hand, you know, with a finance background myself, I know exactly what they're looking for. They've got a portfolio to manage. They need 2 in 10 to knock it out of the park for the returns to come through. So they're looking for quick engagement, quick money generation, so that they can kind of flip and get out. And, you know, from a startup side, a lot of our incubatees who have had dealings with VCs, is they know that the pitfall is that they want you to fail fast or succeed quickly, and they don't have patience, and not all startups work on that hockey stick trajectory, so it's very hard.
So something really to consider before?
Yeah, before taking that level of investment, you need to know where they're going to turn the screws and that your business is ready to do that. Now, not all VCs are the same, so it's, you know, it's finding the right fund. From a media perspective, the interesting thing for us are kind of on a more macro level for VC, and it's not necessarily arrogance, is that there's a cycle, because they follow the money. And media has always struggled with VC investment, because You know, from kind of 5-10 years ago, if you were VC funding, say a Spotify as an example, a lot of that money was then going to the license or the content owners for the content. And actually, as a venture capital fund, that feels odd that, you know, immediately X percent is going out the door to a rights owner rather than to build the business. And so it's taken a long time to kind of break down that actually not all businesses need licenses and it's not all like that. But we've gone through, on a more macro level, we've gone from VCs being quite involved in direct-to-consumer propositions to now SaaS being the model that they're after because, that, well, there are multiple unicorns in that field and also it's they monetize and succeed quite quickly if you connect. So we're now in a position where venture capital has moved to business models away from the ones we would usually be helping to finance. So money's getting harder to find. Which I know one of your questions probably coming is, what other sources are there? Which is why actually angels.
I was going to say angel funds as well, because you can raise you know, a lot from angels.
You can raise a lot from angels because actually, and I was talking to someone last night, we had a big investor event for our incubatees last night. They kind of fall like dominoes. So quite often you'll get, you know, a lead investor who may have a really solid understanding of the industry and therefore understand the value of your business and put a big check. But he's got five mates who also will follow on, and suddenly you've raised 250,000. I mean, I'm making that sound very easy. But,
but also there's the SEIS and EIS tax breaks as well.
And so that's vehicles, they're fantastic. And there are funds that specialise in raising those, well, with those kind of tax efficient structures that are, you know, again, great to connect with. They don't fall into that typical VC category because they know, you know, they know more, they take more risk, basically.
Yeah. Because before starting, that might be something that you just don't even kind of know about. And with SEIS, I think it's like 50% break that you get.
Yeah, I think it's 70% on SEIS and 50 on EIS. Okay. Yeah, so it's really, from an investor perspective, it's really, really good. And actually, very few startups know about that. I think there's, well, hopefully podcasts like this, you know, educate people. But, you know, there are grant systems in almost every kind of industry specialism. There's SEIS and EIS structures that you can put in place yourself and raise, or go to funds that specialize in it. And then you go to angels, or you go to angels and then you're into VC.
What are you most excited about, particularly kind of with female founders and that landscape in the future?
I'm excited about the opportunities that are going to come up, the new business models that are going to come up. I'm reading a book at the moment called Invisible Women. Have you read it?
No, I haven't.
She brings to light all the statistics around the lack of funding on female business models, amongst many other things. You know, not having 50% of the population actually present enough in the startup world means that the ideas that are coming out are, you know,
skewed.
And so men don't see problems that women have at all, really, in that landscape. You know, there's that example of iPhone when they released the facial the voice app first, so Siri first, didn't recognise female voices. You know, they brought out the watch and said it covers your health. It didn't cover the menstrual cycle. Yeah, that they're blind spots because there weren't enough men on the team. I mean, I'm massively.
I've heard that you're more likely to die in a car crash if you're a woman because
I'm on that chapter in the book. Right. I was so cross. Yeah, it's true because the crash test dummy is, the size of an average man and the weight and the anatomy of an average man, and the female one is just a slightly shorter version. They haven't actually adjusted any of the internal anatomy. So yeah,
we've talked about what you're most excited about.
Yeah,
what are you most frustrated about? I know that we've probably covered a few bits of that, and then what do you predict as a final question that will happen
for women? My personal frustration is that I still haven't found a female founder of music tech, and just that there are still not enough female founders out there, and structurally, how do we fix that? I think the other thing is cap table equality. So you hear a lot of people where is a more diverse team, you quite often have a male founder who talks about his co-founder being female, but when you look at the cap table, it isn't an equal equity split. And that's not a co-founder. Mm. So I know that there are a number of female-led VCs who are on a big mission to kind of call that out and change it as they raise financing. And yeah, I think they're my personal frustrations. And then I just wish that the VC world could find a way to back more women. It is changing, but you know, the one they hold up now, I think you and I even discussed it on the phone, is that, you know, LV, what I love about that is that it's such a female product. I would love to have been in the room when she pitched,
yeah,
you know, a pelvic floor trainer to a room full of men. And she's a brilliant example, because their latest product is a silent breast pump. Like, you know, that is innovation we need, yeah, in the world, and only women see that need. Of course, a guy doesn't see that the current breast pump is like a cow shed machine, you know.
Yeah.
But there are more coming through. It's just how do we take that bias out of the room? Maybe it's having more women in VC, you know, that are the professionals in VC, and there are definitely more coming through.
Because funds are being launched, but maybe those funds aren't as big as kind of the other ones. I know that we had, well, we had Albright for a bit, yeah, but then they sort of pivoted.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
Doing research, I suppose, someone as before they're starting to go out and not feel too overwhelmed. I suppose that's, I don't want to frighten people off from going out and doing it.
No, it is imminently doable. It's just, you know, it's backing yourself, being confident, and being realistic, I think, as well, will really move the dial. And like, just the level, I mean, you know yourself, the level of tenacity you need to have, you know, it is, whether male or female, a lot of doors close in your face. And so it's just being able to pick yourself up and knock on the next door, you know, whether that's business development or fundraising, that's just the nature of starting a new business.
Yeah, that it's yeah, not isolated
and actually,
to you.
Build yourself a network and of supporters. And, you know, we've very much focused on evil VC not investing in women. I don't think anyone's doing it consciously. And if I look back on my own career, my biggest supporters have been men. So, you know, if we're trying to break into a man's world, use the men in your network to help you have the right vocabulary, have the right positioning, so that you win people over in that pitch.
Yeah.
It is a bumpy ride being a startup. It's hugely emotionally bumpy as well. And so it's so important that you have a network around you that can help you. And don't be shy to build up a board before you're even the size to warrant a board, because what a board is it is that mentorship circle.
A big thanks to Isabel for coming on the show. You've been listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder with me, Alice Audley. If you have any questions, suggestions for future guests, or want to get in touch, please contact me through my new website, aliceaudley.com, or tweet me at @AliceAudley. That's AUDLEY.